Hello everyone, welcome back to Family Forever Child's Conversation on Care podcast. My name is Amanda Griffith and I'm the CEO of Family Forever Child. Family Forever Child is a growing network of currently 40 local civil society organisations working on the ground in 36 countries. And these organisations have a wealth of knowledge and experience from years of working with children and communities to develop solutions to improve children's care. Today's podcast continues the conversation on kinship care. Family's Kinship Care campaign has run between March and June this year, 2021, and has enabled us to focus on this priority topic. We know that kinship care, that is the care of children by relatives or friends of the family, represents a significant resource available for meeting the needs of girls and boys who are orphaned or otherwise live apart from their parents. It is estimated that 1 in 10 children worldwide are living in kinship care. In some countries, it's as high as 1 in 3. This makes it the most common type of care after parental care. Today, I'm really excited to speak with Kate Bundle, who is the Chief Executive of Grandparents Raising Grandchildren, based in Auckland, New Zealand. Grandparents Raising Grandchildren, or GRHG, was established in 2001 and grew out of a grassroots movement of support groups responding to the difficulties facing kin carers. GRG saw grandparents struggling to adjust their role as caregivers and facing financial, social, and mental health difficulties. So now GHR supports over 9,000 grandparents and 16,000 children, providing caregivers across New Zealand with advocacy support, community outreach, and support groups, information resources, and a trauma-informed education program called SALT, Simply Acquired and Learned Techniques. Kate, welcome to this podcast and thank you for joining me today.
Thank you very much, Amanda. It's great to be with you this evening.
Great. I believe 2021 is GRG's 20th anniversary, so congratulations on that. An excellent milestone to reach.
It is a massive milestone for us.
And obviously demonstrable that you're reaching such scale in New Zealand, which is fantastic. So Kate, perhaps for the benefit of the audience, you could please tell us a bit more about the context around kinship care specifically in New Zealand and GRG's focus is specifically, I know, on grandparents as opposed to other kin carers. Can you provide a picture of the experience of many grandparent caregivers that you support?
Yes, thank you, Amanda. Grandparents Raising Grandchildren Trust was really established 20 years ago to meet that specific need that was identified in our society, in our communities, where grandparents were the ones primarily stepping in to take on the care of children in circumstances where they couldn't be raised by their parents. And it really, grandparents were the alternative to the foster or non-kin state care. And in New Zealand today, it's actually over 25,000. I think it's probably more like around about 27,000 to 30,000 children in care in New Zealand. And the vast majority of them are actually living with their grandparents full time. Our membership's 93% grandparents, and we have 1% that are great grandparents, and 6% identify as other whānau caregivers or kin caregivers. We call them whānau caregivers in New Zealand from the Māori word, which really encompasses family or wider family. So of the 25,000 plus children living in care in New Zealand, only about 5,000 to 6,000 of them are actually in state care. And that's where the state has court orders placing them in the care of a state-approved caregiver. The irony, though, is that the majority of these state-approved caregivers are actually grandparents who have gone through that process of becoming a state-approved foster carer. So they are still, in fact, in kin care of some type for the majority of children. But for these caregivers, they are actually paid a foster care allowance, and the state maintains decision-making powers over their placement. There's arguably good and bad aspects to that, but these children, theoretically at least, through the mechanisms of the child welfare legislation, have ability to access greater supports from the government than children who are not in state care. So you've got 5,000 to 6,000 children in that boat, but for the majority, so that's another 20,000 plus, they are primarily in the care of their grandparents and they're not receiving that foster care allowance. And the context for them is quite different. Remembering that the main reason why these children are in care is usually because of a traumatic family breakdown. The number one reason is usually drug abuse, family violence, neglect, other kinds of abuse. And they too have experienced trauma. And in many cases have the same needs as those children who are in state care, but they don't get that same level of support. So that's sort of the context, that they really struggle to get access to financial support for the children. They experience economic hardship, social isolation, often very much anxiety and stress and grief. It also can lead to depression, and it can be a very, very difficult and challenging experience for them, navigating the various challenges involved in raising someone else's child. So, you know, we also know that even though these children are not in state care, about 70% of them have actually come to the attention of the state's welfare agency. And in New Zealand, that's called Oranga Tamariki. And just looking at figures to the 30th of June 2020, in fact, 58,588 distinct children and young people were the subject of a report of concern as to their welfare. But only 13% of these children actually went through the process that we have under the legislation that governs Oranga Tamariki, our child welfare agency. To actually go through that family group conference process where they have their needs identified, the court orders are obtained, and there is some more defined analysis of what the children need in order to be safe and secure, and, you know, what is going to be the long-term outcomes, you know, in terms of placement, care placement for them. So only 13% go through that process, but only 2% actually end up being taken into state. So there are levels of support and lack of support within the system. And most of the children, as I've said before, end up in grandparent care. And these are mostly informal, we call them huia whānau, family meetings that happen. Sometimes, you know, the social worker will go down the track a little way to helping ensure that there is some sort of safety plan. But most of the time, once they've got that child in a safe care placement with gran and granddad, or in many cases, increasingly, it's just gran on her own, and in about 4% of cases, just granddad on his own, you know, they are literally left holding the baby once they've been identified as a safe pair of hands for these children. And that's where they really, really struggle, because they don't know what to do next. And there is, you know, often little support given to them at that juncture, unless they get a good social worker who says, go and see grandparents raising grandchildren. You know, go and get financial support via the other mechanisms under the social welfare legislation. And that's a big part of where we come in.
So you've read some really interesting things there, which I know internationally people are really exploring, which is this: to what extent do you go formal and to what extent do you leave this informal? And it sounds to me like you've got actually some interesting levels of formality, because the one is the actual going into through the foster care system, which you said there was a caveat to that, and I'd be interested in that caveat to that. And then there seems to be, even in the informal one, at least there is a social worker engaged in that and aware of the family. So because I guess the most informal is that this is a process that's agreed within the family, and the state system is completely unaware of those transitions within the family. And I don't know to what extent that also happens, but maybe you could just explore with me a little bit further, because I know it's something that people are really interested in, is the sort of, I guess, the advantages and disadvantages of going that fully formal way of going through the foster care route, and how that's played out in New Zealand as to both the advantages to families to do that and potentially some of the downsides to that.
Yes, in a purely theoretical sense, when you look at the legislation that we've got, the Oranga Tamariki Act, there is some really good stuff in there that actually is designed to, ensure that the system looks to what is the child's best interests and well-being needs, and ensuring that the family that takes on the care of the child is going to be well-placed and set up with the resources they need to ensure that child's needs are met. But that's, and you know, there's all sorts of mechanisms there around support orders and access to additional financial support. But the real problem is that the process for going through that formal route involves it's a very long time to become an approved caregiver. There's lots of hoops you can go through, and with the number of children coming to the attention of the social workers, the child protection social workers, 58,000 children being reported to them, and that's not counting the numbers of reports of concern. So there's actually 80,000 reports of concern over the course of the year. The emphasis seems to be on finding a quick fix. So the benefit of going through the process, sort of pushing back a little bit on the social worker and saying, okay, hold on, yes, I am really keen to step up and be the caregiver as the grandparent of my grandchildren. Grandparents invariably, in my experience, will walk over hot coals for their grandchildren. You know, there is that incredible bond of unconditional love that they have, and in the Māori context as well, those children are precious. They are our taonga. You know, they are part of the whole whakapapa whakapapa in Māori. You know, it's the genealogical links. They are precious. They are treasures. You know, children. And, it's like cutting off the arm of a tree to have that child go into non-kin care. But it's the same for all grandparents, really, of all ethnicities. They will do anything they can to protect them. So there's a real fine line where they need to ensure that they push back enough and say, okay, yes, I will, but I need to ensure that these children have the supports that they need. And often they don't know about this. So that's where it's really important to get advocacy support right from the get-go from agencies like GRG. Because if they go through the process, they can then become what is deemed to be a permanent caregiver. And later on down the track, when a child hits puberty and, the triggered trauma from their early childhood, even though they may have had years of being settled with Gran and be really quite doing very well, that teenage stage actually really brings up a lot for all adolescents. So they often can go off the rails there, and they need extra help. So going through the process is really good if you can stomach it. And knowing that you've got the state looking over your shoulder, and whereas the majority of grandparents don't want to have a bar of social workers. Mm. And so it's finding that sweet spot where you get the support, you get what you need in a way that is going to ensure the mana integrity of the family and the child's sense of belonging in a way that's not re-traumatizing them, if you know what I mean. So, yes, it's very layered, it's very complex, and each case is different, but there are some threads that are similar, obviously. I'm not sure if that's...
No, that's really helpful, and I know that this is something that many countries are really exploring. Is where do you go on this? And some countries have said actually we've gone too formal because, as you say, actually the family wants to maintain its integrity, and not feel that it's suddenly transitioned into some sort of state provision. So that's really useful insights in terms of that. So in terms of that context, which you very clearly outlined for us. What is it that GHG actually really focuses on doing in responding to that context?
Yes, so our real focus is to empower these grandparent caregivers with the knowledge and the resources they need so that they can provide that safe, loving, you know, home that provides the security that the children need to thrive. And so our services, they are specialised, so we're not trying to be all things to all people, but they're specialised in that we're trying to strengthen the family. We're trying to ensure that Gran has what she needs, the tools, so whether that's information resources, whether it's advocacy support, and that's increasingly important, we find, and particularly when, you know, it might be at the beginning of the caregiver journey. It might actually be later on down the track, and they come to us and say, look, I really need help. There's been a crisis in the family and I don't know what to do. It might be to do with, you know, the parents suddenly turning up on the scene again and wanting contact with the children. So we can be there at all stages, but ultimately what we want to do is ensure that they have what they need to be resilient, to be able to overcome challenges further on down the track. So advocacy is a key part of it. You know, we have an 0800 Grans helpline that they can access. It's free. And through that, we get referrals from other agencies and we get grandparents contacting us sometimes for the first time, sometimes for the 100th time. If they need to, we will refer them through to one of the advocates. And the advocates, there's sort of two areas of specialisation. One is in the financial supports and having an understanding of the Social Security Act legislation, and knowing the difference between the foster care regime and the social welfare regime, understanding the tax implications. They often need our support to advocate for them. And there is a key benefit that grandparents who are raising someone else's child can get in our country. If they are the primary caregiver and are going to be the primary caregiver of someone else's child for at least 12 months, then they can get what they call the unsupported child benefit. There's about 18,000 children in New Zealand who are receiving this benefit. And one of the things that we did years ago was advocate over a number of years to have the rate of the unsupported child benefit increased so it was on the same level as the base rate for the foster care allowance. Yeah. And, you know, various other supports as well. So that's a key thing. Too many grandparents don't get advised of their eligibility. So that's another area where we come in and we will, you know, go through to benefit review hearings, appeals, review processes in order to ensure that they get the entitlements that they're, you know, they get what they're entitled to at law. So that's a key bit. And then the other side of it is having an advocate who can help guide you through the family court process, dealing with social workers, finding out what is going on in their case, sort of decoding what the the social workers and the lawyers are saying about where things are at. Because these grandparents quite often, you know, they really don't understand what is going on. And And it can be very complex, and they're really tired and they're overwhelmed. So they come to us, and also we provide emotional support, that listening ear as well, and an understanding. So we have the advocacy, the information resources, the 0800 number, and we also have a network of support groups around the country, and they are volunteer-led, and they really are the lifeblood of our organisation nationally. Now, we have a national support office in Auckland, but nationally we have these support groups. There's around 40 plus 9 coffee groups that are a bit more informal again, but they are what provide that social community link, emotional support, and support workers who will, you know, go along to family group conferences and be by their side and be able to sort of help them understand what's really going on and decisions that are being made, whether it's in the family court or in a Oranga Tamariki family group conference situation. So, and to a much lesser degree, we also have donations come in from the public, which we then distribute clothing, essentials for children. And, you know, we have an army of wonderful knitters out there in the country who are donating, you know, beautiful blankets and things. And, you know, so many of these children, when they come into the care of the grandparent, they might be lucky if they have a plastic bag full of their belongings. They might not even have that. You know, the number of grandparents who will get a call from a social worker on a Friday night and say, you need to take on these children. No nappies, no cot, no blankets, no clothes, you know, and that's where we come in to help as well. And of course, we've got our SALT program, which you mentioned at the beginning.
And I'll explore with you a bit more. But I think you've raised some really interesting points, even within in talking through that, which, and that is that the kinship care is so different because it's a family in crisis. Mm-hmm. And as you've outlined, it sort of, it can be, and it's not just one generational, because obviously the grandparent is also concerned about their immediate child and what the situation is with that. And the complexity over a period of time, that this isn't this is what it looks like, and that's how it continues to look like, is obviously that what happens with the actual parental family is a changing landscape over time, and therefore the grandparents are interacting with the care of the grandchild, but also the care of their own child, and the complexities that that particular parental group is going through over time. So I think when you talk about the sort of the emotional load, I think the emotional load is too generational that they're carrying, not just the care of the child, which is, and I know that sort of you were referencing to some of the causes of this, which is sort of things like drug and alcohol abuse. And I know that in conversation with you about another organisation that's working in New Zealand, is also those where children go into prison. So then you're facing the complexities of that whole thing too. As you say, these things can happen overnight. It's not a prepared situation. And therefore, for both the child and the grandparents, they're into a point of emergency response in many respects to that.
Yeah. Yes, definitely.
So maybe in that context, it would be really useful if you could explore a little bit more about your SALT program and how that works.
Yes. So this is a program that we designed, and it developed organically, in a sense, out of the learnings from our research. And we had a workshop program prior to doing our 2016 major piece of research that was focused on trying to ensure that each support group, new support group, was set up in the right way and could be a real source of support, emotional support for the grandparents in that particular area. But out of the research, we learned so much about what the grandparents were dealing with and the challenges they were having with the children's behaviour. And, you know, they were unable to access programs that were catering to their needs, you know, there's lots of parenting programs out there. Mm-hmm. And there was the National Caregiver Training Program for foster carers. But that was sort of quite prescriptive and very much around the foster care, non-kin care dynamic. So we realized there really needs to be something for these grandparents, because they were struggling with triggered behavior and challenging behavior. And of course, we learned in our research also that 41% of the children in grandparent care actually have been diagnosed with some sort of psychological or cognitive disability or disorder, and it may be related to their exposure to alcohol in utero, or drugs in the environment, or both, or because of the trauma they'd experienced, you know, anxiety and attachment disorders, and then there was the autism spectrum as well, over on top of the trauma that they'd experienced. And but we actually found that even with the 41%, 65% of those children actually it was a conduct type disorder that they'd been diagnosed with, which was, you know, clearly the majority of children. And then a further 20% had been identified by the grandparents as probably having one of those sorts of, you know, they were struggling to get a diagnosis. The child was either too young, or they couldn't find a professional, or they couldn't afford a professional diagnosis. So all of that really was the development of our understanding that we need to do something. And so we looked at trauma-informed care programs and realised that we needed to do something that was specifically for the grandparent care dynamic, and in a way that they could understand. And that's where we came up with it's four modules in a workshop that's delivered usually with the support group, so that after the event the support group can continue to develop that understanding and collegial sort of support, social support. And what we found was that the support group coordinators would often take the lead later on down the track when a caregiver had a crisis, and they would bring them back to the SALT learning. So the learning continues in a very supported environment. And so the key thing is, you know, understanding what is triggering the behaviour and how to respond to it in a way that is not going to escalate the conflict and stress in the family and the relationship the grandmother has with the grandchild. But instead in a way that will de-escalate that conflict and ensure that there is a communication between gran and the child in a safe way that actually over time and you know, children who've experienced trauma, they'll either keep acting out and being really challenging, or they'll withdraw. And it was actually helping grandparents to understand the difference in the behaviour, the front brain against the, you know, the limbic brain response, how to pick it, you know, little tips on how to pick it, whether the child's dissociating or whether they actually really are acting rationally and being really difficult, you know, deliberately. You know, so the way we do it is through sort of four key modules that look at understanding, you know, what grandchildren need, what grandparents do, you know, providing that routine and stability, and then sort of moving on to understanding that the neurological aspects, the front brain, back brain type responses, and you know, sort of the nurture versus consequence sort of scenario, and escalation, de-escalation. And we do an enabling exercise with them as well. So it's a case scenario which every single grandparent who's ever gone through the program goes, oh my God, you know, I understand. You know, and this is the thing, we get them to that light bulb moment where they go, ah, now I see. Because, you know, we all operate to patterns of behaviour that we've learned. And sometimes it's actually a pattern of behaviour or enabling behaviour that actually it leads to other unintended consequences. Whereas if you, you know, identify what you should have done in the beginning and how different the consequence of it would have been, you know. These sorts of exercises that are based on real situations that grandparents have found themselves in and unpicking, you know, what would have been different if they'd done this, and really layers upon layers their understanding of how they can care for the children in a way that has a great deal more insight into the dynamics. So it's very practical and simple. You know, we don't use big language and we don't go into big research terms. But
it's a really interesting combination that you've described in both all of your services and specifically in this, which is actually very technically informed, high level technical informed, whether that, you know, with the psychological understanding, but then also combining that with the support systems that are much more sort of, you know, sort of intangible but important and practical. And so it's bringing those two together in a way that then gives techniques and understanding for grandparents to know what the context in which they're operating and naming things and actually being able to sort of appreciate things. But I'm guessing also make connections amongst each other to say, I'm not alone in this. This is a common experience to others. Mm-hmm. And I'm imagining also gives insights into, oh, what was it about my parenting relationship with my immediate child, which is also now, you know, am I replicating those behaviours and could inform their relationship with their immediate child as well in terms of that family dynamic?
Yes, absolutely it does, because, you know, they're not operating in a vacuum. They're not, you know, their family still is their family, and the children, the parents of these children are still around and they still have contact. And, you know, that's either good or bad depending on where the parent's at in their own recovery. But, you know, it's incredibly important for them to get that understanding, because it does help them with their relationship with their child, most definitely. And, you know, we did some surveying of our clients recently, and this one comment particularly stuck out in my mind from a grandmother who'd gone through the SALT program, and she said, I had 4 sessions with a psychologist about the situation I'm dealing with my grandchild, and I got more out of the SALT workshop program and understanding that I got in all of those sessions, you know, at great cost. So we know we're doing something right.
Yeah, well, and also what I thought was really interesting is what I think is crucial is that this is not a one-off. You are in a volatile environment in which, exactly as you say, is that it may be that the family gets to a point in which it's functioning really well, and then something else triggers, and then the need to then sort of go to another level of support is needed. And those things, so it's a very long-term relationship that needs to be in place rather than a one-off experience this, be trained in this, and then, you know, keep going.
Yeah. Oh, look, we have got grandparents who have gone through it more than once, you know, you know, 2-3 times in some cases, and they learn more and pick up more each time, because each group dynamic is different as well. And that's where the facilitator's skill is really, you know, fantastic, you know, to be able to read that group and pull out some of the issues that they are dealing with that might not have been covered in the previous workshop.
Fascinating. So if we can move on slightly then from the specifics of what raising grandchildren do with kinship carers and the children within their care, what else have you done at a national policy level in terms of advocating for change? You referenced to one, which I think is a really important one, actually, which is that to say that the benefits that come to those equivalent to foster care, because in some countries I know whereby, because foster care payments are greater, it's been a draw to take children out of kinship care, because the parents are sort of saying, well, in that environment they get better financial support and things. So that is a really interesting piece of legislative change that you've asked for, well, and achieved. But just talk a bit more about how part of your remit is also that looking at this policy environment.
Absolutely. So national advocacy and you know, for want of a better description, you know, thought leadership around, you know, what kinship care is and, you know, the importance of supporting children who can't be raised by their parents. That's a big part of what we do as well. And, you know, talking about the parity between foster care and non-state care children, you know, we started advocating for that back in, you know, 2001 onwards. And over the years, we did research 2005, 2009, and then again, the big one in 2016. And those issues about the lack of financial supports for grandparents that were really magnified. But we managed to convince the government in 2008 to increase the unsupported child benefit and the orphans benefit rates to the same level as foster care at the base. And we also managed to influence them to look at what additional supports these children need. And we surveyed our members to find out, well, what would be really helpful for them, because the government was signalling that they were going to set aside some money for support of children in extended whānau care or family care. And one of the key things was the beginning of the school year is really, really difficult for grandparents. You know, uniform costs, school fees, activity costs, et cetera, et cetera. And it always comes after Christmas in New Zealand. You know, back into the school year in January and they are broke. And so having a set amount that these children were eligible for was sort of ranged between $450 and $550, depending on their age. That was an enormous support. Just having a little bit of support when the child first came into their care. So there was an establishment grant that was made. And then there was another fund that was set up called the Extraordinary Care Fund, which was designed to enable children to potentially get access to, it was an application process for an additional $2,000 per year for circumstances where they might be, you know, showing promise in a particular skill or hobby or sport or arts or something, or they may be experiencing difficulty. And that's been very, very helpful for many children over the years. And so that was to try and sort of compensate for the fact that children in foster care, you know, they get the cost of their extra stuff paid for, you know, whether it's dental costs, medical costs, all that stuff. And then we more recently in 2013 worked together with a member of parliament to develop a bill that would allow children receiving the orphans benefit and the unsupported child benefit to also get a clothing allowance like foster care children did. And we were very lucky that that private member's bill actually got drawn in the ballot and it went through and eventually came into law in July 2018. And so now children on the UCB and OB, they get the same rate as foster carers for the clothing allowance. So, you know, gradually we're sort of they're there and we're sort of coming up here, can imagine steps, we're almost at the same level, but not quite. And as a result of all of these changes, the government has started looking at the policy overall for support for children being raised by someone other than their parents. And so there's a review happening of foster care allowance, the higher foster care allowance, the orphan's benefit and the unsupported child benefit. And as a representative of Grandparents Raising Grandchildren Trust, and our significant membership in New Zealand, I'm on that policy panel reviewing the legislation, the level of support needed. And I'm really pleased that over the course of the last 18 months, there've been some additional changes made. And one key thing is something that we've been hot on for years, and that is that to get the unsupported child benefit or the orphan's benefit, you have to be able to say that you are going to be raising that child for at least 12 months. And that sounds fine in theory, but often when children go into grandparent care, it's at the behest of a social worker saying, look, these children, you know, we need somewhere safe for them. Can you take them on? We're not going to go down the foster care route for you because we think that they will ultimately go back to their parents. But meanwhile, you know, thank you very much. You can look after them. And the grandmother goes, oh, you know, what financial support do I get? And, you know, they might say, oh, well, you know, go down the road and see work and income and get a benefit and apply for the unsupported child benefit. But if the case manager at work and income says, well, you know, you're not going to have these children for more than a year because there's a court case coming up or the mum's getting out of prison soon, you know, no, you're not eligible for it. So that temporary care situation has been a big black period of no support, and it's caused enormous hardship for grandparents. So we have finally got the government to agree to that, and a bill went to the Select Committee. The report just came out the other day and there's support for it, and so it's likely to go to the House for its second reading soon, and fingers crossed all will go to plan and it will be passed. And that will really ensure that from the get-go, when a child goes into care, they will get access to the financial support they need for their reasonable daily needs from that point onwards, whether it's temporary, you know, for a month, 2 months, 3 months, 4 months, or longer. So that's brilliant. So we feel very proud of that achievement.
And I think out of that, Kate, what's really interesting is what you're demonstrating is that you combined both. You did research consistently. I mean, you've referenced to several dates in which you've done research and surveys, but you've also, because you're working directly with the cohort, you're bringing through their lived experience. You're able to say, you know, this is the actual reality on the ground that needs to be addressed, and these are where the crunch points are or where the failures in the system are, because this is what people are experiencing. And it's the power of bringing together not just the research but also that practical understanding that then combines to make for very authentic but also very powerful advocacy by the sounds of it, and understanding therefore and also understanding the process by which you can achieve and the commitment to the long term, because these are not quick gains. They are very and you're having to work through quite a complex system, a political system, to achieve those changes. So that's really insightful, thank you. You've spoken a lot about the impact of your work, and I didn't know whether there was anything else you wanted to highlight in terms of that, or whether we moved on to what advice you would give to other practitioners hoping to develop similar support systems, because yours is a very holistic and comprehensive one and developed over the 20 years. So I wondered your insights for those that are at the beginning of this journey, what you would be saying to them about what to think about.
Yes. Oh, look, I mean, I think that the best advice I could give to other practitioners and other countries looking to what works and what is the best kind of support for kinship carers is is research is critical. You know, doing your own research so that you understand the needs of the caregivers, you understand what they're saying, you understand the pain points in the system and how they might be overcome, because, you know, every context is different, but there are obviously some threads that are the same for all. And ultimately, you know, all children, they have that right to have a safe, you know, home to grow up in. They have that right to have a sense of where they fit in and identity and belonging to their family. And so all of those things, I mean, we think about the Convention of the Rights of the Child, you know, all of those things are fundamental. They have a right to the basic needs of, you know, shelter, clothing, food. So when you factor in all of those basic things that they need and you understand where the pain points are in the system that is stopping them from getting what they need, and there are disincentives in the system for caregivers, to grandparents or other members of the family, to take on the care of the children, if you understand why that's happening, and look to systems like our own for, you know, how it can work better. And I think that, you know, really understanding the research and tapping into, you know, in our research, you know, we've got literature review of lots and lots of studies on the benefits of kinship care and how important it is for children to grow up with that sense of belonging within their family, a sense of identity. And in our country, particularly, you know, the context for Māori, it is integral that, you know, you are, you belong, you have that whakapapa and whanaungatanga sense of belonging to your family. And it's a very real and alive thing in New Zealand. You know, Māori families know their genealogical links, you know, all the way back. And every child deserves that right to know. And so we value that. And I think that in all cultures there is that value. And so look to the research in your own context, learn from that what your caregivers are saying, and yes, identify and understand those pain points in the system and how you can overcome them. I think those are my key messages around that.
But I think that's fantastic, and I think that's a really accurate summary. The one thing I would notice is actually what you've also said, which I think is really important to us, I think, is how fundamentally different kinship care is from other types of alternative care. That this is, and what that means to the child, what it means to the whole family, is, and that's not all. It's not just about the financial and things. It is this incredibly important emotional bond, this sense of identity, this sense of belonging, which you cannot replicate, and which is so integral to a child growing up feeling confident about who they are. So that sort of the psychological impact of that is so very vital. That, and yet, as you say, even within the sophisticated environment of New Zealand, people hadn't been recognising that, and that is something that's really, I think, anybody working on kinship care needs to really emphasise and pull that together. So, Kate, thank you. That has been so insightful. You've given us an awful lot of great examples, but also some really fantastic indications of how one can develop a very comprehensive and well thought through support program, and more than a program, a really support intervention around kinship carers and their children and their grandchildren, to enable them to have all access to both legal, financial, emotional and ongoing support. So Thank you so much. It's been really insightful, and I'm sure that's been of great use to all of the listeners. So
thank you, Amanda. Thank you very much for, you know, giving us this opportunity to talk about our work and for the focus on the kinship care, which is so important for children.
Thank you so much for engaging and sharing so openly about GRG's fantastic and wide-ranging work to support vulnerable grandparent carers and the children in their care. And thank you to those of you joining us to listening to this Conversation on Care podcast. We invite you to engage further in our conversation and activities on this topic by joining our Kinship Care community on the Changemaker for Children's community platform. To do this, you can visit, all one word, changemakersforchildren.community to register. The more users there are, the stronger we will be. We hope you will enjoy us, join us next time, and thank you for listening, and goodbye.